I thought about beginning this sermon with some funny joke to get people laughing. But I thought, no, that wouldn't seem quite right. But I wanted to share a story that captures some of the drama of this story between Abraham and Sarah and the three men who are visiting, and that important thread of laughter indeed. It's a story that someone from the congregation actually sent to me, thought I needed a good laugh and could relate to it. It goes like this. My husband and I had been happily, most of the time, in parenthesis, married for 5 years but hadn't been blessed with a baby. I decided to do some serious praying and promised God that if He would give us a child, I would be a perfect mother. Love it with all my heart and raise it with His word as my guide. Well, God answered my prayers and blessed us with a son. The next year, God blessed us with another son. The following year, He blessed us with yet another son. The year after that, we were blessed with a daughter. And my husband thought that we were blessed right into poverty. Now we had 4 children, and the oldest was only 4 years old. I learned never to ask God for anything unless I meant it. A minister once told me, if you pray for rain, make sure you carry an umbrella. While I couldn't keep my promise to be a perfect mother, I didn't even come close. I did keep my promise to raise them in the Word of God. I knew I was missing the mark just a little when I told my daughter we were going to church to worship God and she wanted to bring a bar of soap along to wash up Jesus also. Something was lost in the translation when I explained that God gave us everlasting life and my son thought it was generous of God to give us his last wife. Laughter and prayer and surprises in that story sounds a lot like our text. Sounds a lot indeed like what happened to Abraham and Sarah in the visit of those men. Picture the scene, if you would. Thousands of years ago, in a region of the world that, yes, we know all too well, Mamre, they're sitting by the oaks of Mamre, Abraham and Sarah, the nomadic people with his family and his servants and his herd, moving from place to place, finding grazing fields and survival. They are on the move, and they have camped for a time at the oaks of Mamre. Mamre is about 9 kilometers or so north of Hebron. And there they are. And I want you to come with me into this story. See if you can picture and feel and taste the dryness of that arid space. The searing heat of the noonday sun. For the text opens up indeed that the Lord came to visit Abraham. We do not know, we know more than Abraham knows at this point, because Abraham is sitting in the shelter of his tent, the flap that was extended over the main portion of the tent, finding some relief from the searing heat. What was he doing? I don't know. Thinking, pondering. His life had been one woven journey, especially since the promise some 25 years ago that he and Sarah would be the parents to a new nation, to bless the nations of the world and to have a special people indeed that he would bequeath and be the progenitor of. All those grandiose thoughts here 25 years later had not materialized. What could Abraham have been thinking in that flap-covered shade of his tent as he pondered, maybe sweltering, maybe just wondering if this promise would ever come true? Maybe disappointed, maybe feeling some shame for the way that he had treated Sarah over the years. Maybe a little bit embarrassed in the confines and privacy of his own mind and imagination for the way that his mind perhaps had turned against Sarah, because he had to endure, although it was focused towards her, the shame of a barren wife. No child. No one to carry forth his name. No insurance in their old age. No hedge against poverty. No pension plan which children provided in those desperate circumstances. Here, what was Abraham thinking? Whatever it was that he was thinking, it is interrupted by the sight of three strangers coming towards him. All of a sudden, perhaps in the woeful thoughts that he might have been preoccupied with, he jumps up and springs into action. He jumps up and he practices the age-old tradition of hospitality that is still evident in many parts of the Middle East. Bedouin culture, if anyone comes, doesn't matter who they are, comes into your camp near your tent, you are to extend a hospitality to them that is gracious and beneficent. And so he springs up, and we're told the impeccable way in which he keeps this tradition. He runs towards them. And first, we know the tradition that in the Middle East, for elderly men to run is not an acceptable practice in ancient times. But he runs towards them, and he bows low, we're told, showing them deference and respect. And he welcomes them and says, as the game goes, and I say that not in a derogatory way, but people knew the custom. He says, if you find it pleasant and favorable to stay with me, to receive my hospitality, then be it so. And he says, I will get a little bit of water and a morsel of bread to entertain you. And everyone knew that you understated what you were really going to do, and the men agree. What is interesting in the text, when you look in the Hebrew, is the way in which Abraham addresses the three. It is obvious that in the midst, because we're told, as the narrator tells us, so the reader knows more than Abraham at this point, that the Lord is coming to visit. So among the three, God is somehow present. And the leader of the group, as it were. And so Abraham addressed what looks like the leader of the three through the singular pronoun, your. If you indeed find it pleasant, your servant, naming himself. And then he says, you come and refresh your feet, plural, to all those who are there. So he does recognize something, but he's not sure what. And then the story unfolds. See if you can hear the urgency in his voice as he seeks to fulfill all of those demands and requirements of hospitality. He barks out commands to his wife, to Sarah, who traditionally would be kept away in the tent and not come forward, not to show her face as was the custom. But he says to prepare this meal and prepare all that was necessary. And he speaks to her similarly as he speaks later on to his servant, whom he assigns to prepare the calf that he has chosen from among his herd. Have things come to that now, where Abraham is treating his wife as one of the servants, one of the slaves? Has it come to that now? Anyway, the story unfolds, and Abraham himself becomes, as it were, attentive to the needs of his guests. He sets them under the shade of the tree and have them refresh their feet, wash their feet, as is the custom, and brings to them not just a morsel of bread and a little water, but brings to them a huge, sumptuous feast. The details that are described about the amount of flour that he asked Sarah to prepare and the calf that was roasted and given to them was a huge, sumptuous feast. And he goes and he serves it and he waits to see if they need anything else. And that's an opening setting. And it's interesting. Seems rather mundane. But then the story turns in verse 9. And here's where we want to spend our time in focus. The men, and it's a very interesting thing that the text has all of them speaking at the same time. It kind of reminded me of any of you who watch Star Trek, you know, the Borg, they all talk along with each other the same way. Or in The Matrix, you know, the agents in the speak all the same language, communicate with each other. They all speak at the same time. And they say, where is your wife, Sarah? Now, you might think it might occur to Abraham, how do they know the name of my wife? Who are these people, really? But the text gives no indication that this disturbs him. He says, which is the tradition and the custom, she's in the tent. She's back there. And so the story shifts. And it's important for us to recognize the significance of this particular shift. The reason being that up until now in the story, in the saga, Sarah has been relegated to a marginal role, either in the text or by Abraham himself. Do you remember going back to chapter 12, and it's been 25 years in their lives when the promise was made to Abram to leave his place and to go to a country that would be shown to them. Sarah follows along, and as they approach Egypt, what is the first thing? This promise has been given to him. And so Abraham, afraid of his own skin before they go in and enter into Egypt because of the famine that had arisen, he says to her, "Now, you are very beautiful, Sarah. And they will look on you and they will see that you are my wife and they will kill me and take you. So you know what? This is what I'm telling you you need to do. When we go there, tell them, we will tell them that you are my sister so that it may go well for me." Does that sound like Sarah's best interest? Don't think so. And when they do enter Egypt, Sarah is taken into the court, as it were, of the Pharaoh, and things go well indeed. For Abraham, he's given many riches and things. And soon this is discovered because plagues come and they're driven out of Egypt. It's not the first time. It's not the only time, I should say, that Abraham does this. He does it again with the king of Gerar. Gives his wife away after the promise has been made. What is wrong with Abraham? Does he not trust the promises of God? You see, it is important to see how the emphasis is shifted. The emphasis shifts now to Sarah. And Sarah overhears the men talking. And they ask where she is. And they say to Abraham, "We will come back next year in the springtime." The time of life, it says in Hebrew. Ka'at chaya. In the springtime, and she will bear a son. Now, you have to understand this. Sarah is about 90 years old. Abraham is 100 years old. Sarah hears it. The text tells us already what has happened to her. The text tells us that she has long been now past the manner of women. In other words, menopause has set in. She is beyond child-rearing age. She knows it. Nobody has to tell her that because she has been reminded over and over by the custom of the day and perhaps by the daily treatment of her husband. I don't know, but it seems that certainly they are estranged to some extent. She has been reminded over and over that she is barren. The women probably have laughed at her. She is used to this now. She is used to the curse of that culture for not having borne not only a child, but particularly a son. Nobody has to tell her. She knows she's past birthing capability. And so when she hears this, that next year in springtime, you're going to have a baby, what does she do? What does she do? She laughs. She laughs, the text says, to herself. She laughs with the knowledge of one who knows how biology works. She laughs as one who does not anymore believe that promise, some 25 years old. She just cannot fathom with the incredulity of the reality of life. It seems in her mind perhaps has trumped the promises of God. So she laughs to herself and says to herself, "How can this be? I'm worn out. My husband is old." In fact, there's an interesting tradition in the Talmud, in the Jewish writings, that says that what she really said was that I'm worn out, but my husband is too old. And because Abraham did not hear this directly, God is reported to have told Abraham what she said, but he changed it and said, she said, because she is too old in order to keep peace between them. I thought that's an interesting kind of interpretation. But nonetheless, she laughs at that. "I'm worn out. This can't happen." And the three men begin now to reveal that in the midst of them is the Lord indeed. And the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh?" How is Abraham supposed to know that? Sarah laughed to herself. Abraham doesn't know. But this just creates a backdrop, a foil, in other words, for the most important question of this text indeed to come forth and say, shall I bear a son now that I am old? And here is the question posed to Abraham, indeed posed to Sarah, and I dare say posed to you, every single one of you, and to me, because it makes all the difference. The question is anything too hard for the Lord? Some ways of interpreting that word hard, actually in Hebrew, could also mean, is anything too wonderful for the Lord? That's the key question. That's a question you and I have to answer, because our answer to that question will determine how we live in the world, how we view God, how we trust God, whether or not this God whom we worship, whom we follow, is indeed capable of doing that which God promises. Is this God capable of penetrating every compartment of my life? Or have I, like you, separated our lives and says, yes, God, you can do this, but this is too big for you. This that I'm going through, you can't even touch this. You can't change this situation. You can't even begin to imagine what I am facing. Our answer to that question is the key. It would seem to us, reading this text and knowing the story beforehand, that Abraham and Sarah's answer for the time being to this particular question is yes. There are some things too great for you, God. There are some things that even you cannot do, because you promised us 25 years ago that we would bear a son, that we would somehow be the progenitors of a great nation, be a blessing to the world. We are not seeing any hint of that. Anywhere, anytime. It's been a long time. So the answer is yes. They don't come right out and say that, but her laughter of incredulity. And Abraham in chapter 17 had laughed. He fell on his face laughing when he was reminded of this promise. They do not believe it anymore, it would seem. And is it not true that you and I, perhaps who have at one time lived in close proximity and intimacy with God, have encountered the vicissitudes of life, the things that impede our ability to feel positive and upbeat about stuff, and we too have come to that marginal place where we wonder, God, have you forgotten your promise? Have you forgotten about me? About what I'm going through? This chronic disease, this relationship horror and nightmare in which I am, this trouble with my children, this lack of a job, this whatever, have you forgotten me? You promise, God. What is our answer to that question? Is anything too hard for the Lord? Is anything too wonderful for God? And we, like Abraham and Sarah, we laugh. You know that laugh. It's not a comfortable laugh. It's a nervous laugh. It's a kind of laugh that maybe is a little bit cynical. It's a little bit sarcastic, perhaps. We laugh like Sarah and Abraham. Because you know why? Sometimes in our lives, it seems like a joke, a cruel joke. This promise of God to be with us, to sustain us, to heal us, to bless us, to hold us, to caress us, to lead us, to show us, to reveal to us. It seems like a cruel joke when we don't see that happening and we laugh. But the story continues. The story continues and meets Abraham and Sarah where they are. Sarah is embarrassed to be discovered. Her private thoughts have somehow now become known to these three men and her husband. She laughed. She said, I'm worn out. My husband is old. I am old. How do you expect this drooping womb and these drooping breasts to suckle a child? How do you expect me to give life in my state? Just look at me. And it is that experience that causes her to be afraid. And fear is the parent of lies in many cases, and the parent of unfaith and doubt. And the text tells us that Sarah lied and said, when confronted, she did not laugh. You and I know about fear. And when we are afraid, we do things and say things and be things that we know are not our best selves, that are not our calling. Fear will do that to you and to me. It did it to Sarah, and she lied and said, I did not laugh. And God does not berate her. God does not punish her. God does not embarrass her. Simply states the fact. Yes, you did laugh. But you see, God always has the last laugh. Because in chapter 21, which is part of our reading, it goes on to talk about the birth. Yes, indeed, the next springtime, just as the men had said, just as the Lord had said, they come back and Sarah gives birth to a child, to a son. And the text says, the Lord did unto Sarah as he promised. God's graciousness indeed might take a time, might take a while, might not manifest itself as we would want it to, in the specific agenda and order and fashion that we would want. But it will take place, because God always has the last laugh. And the text says, he did unto Sarah as he promised he would. And Sarah gave birth to a son. And they named that son, what? What did they name the son? Isaac, which means laughter, which means he laughs. Some people believe God laughs. In other words, God participates in the laughter that for them had been a laughter of hopelessness, a laughter of incredulity, a laughter of doubt. Their laughter scoffed at the very possibility of God being able to do the impossible. And in a sense of humor and yet profound grace and mercy, this God participates in that laughter and transforms it into a laughter of hope. A laughter of promise realized and fulfilled, so that every time they call their son in for supper or call their son to participate in something, they would be reminded. They are saying, laughter, come here, dinner's ready. Laughter, stop picking your nose. Laughter, come and join with the family games. Every time they call that name, they would remember that this God, whom they did not believe could fulfill the promise, was daily reminding them that you need to answer that question. Is anything too wonderful? Is anything too hard for the Lord? Answer that question with a resounding no. Every day they are reminded of this Isaac. So Abraham and Sarah are not paragons of virtue. They are not the kind of superheroes that whose lives do not betray doubt and hardship and foibles like you and like me. And so this is the gracious invitation of the text that says you, each of you and I, can be like Abraham and Sarah, filled in the midst of our unfaith and our questions and our fear and our lies. We too can be visited by God. We too can have those things that we have long given up on fulfilled in God's time, in God's way, not according to our agenda. Isn't this a gracious gift? It's a gracious gift. Laughter, Isaac, is that symbol that reminds them to transform hopelessness into hope. That God's capacity to rescue us from our worst nightmare is as sure as God's word. Where do we see that? I don't have to chronicle it in your lives, but I invite you to ponder and to ask. But I want to share two examples. As many of you know, I'm on the board of the mission, and we have so many wonderful stories that are told. In our hospice, which is the only hospice in the first hospital, I believe the only hospice in all of Canada for street involved for homeless people, dedicated specifically for them. We have people who come in the last time or season of their lives. And there, the miracle that occurs is not so much that they are saved from death, but it is what happens to many of them who had long since given up on being reconciled with their families, whom they had treated desperately poorly. For somehow, in the last season of their lives, to be visited by those who were most dear to them. And the miracle of that joy on their faces, with the embrace around their frail bodies, and their wide smiles, often toothless, bodies racked with cancer or AIDS, is to die for. The miracle of what they believe to be impossible, there evident before our very eyes, a testimony to the promise of God. And the second story comes this past week from our own national history. In the afternoon of Wednesday, when Prime Minister Harper made that apology to the Aboriginal community, the first person to respond from the circle of elders who were gathered there was Phil Fontaine. With his traditional dress and headdress and feathers, he stood, and among the many very gracious and yet truthful and pointed things he said was that this day and this apology is nothing less than a miracle. For we had not thought that this day would ever come. Over 100 years of desperately shunting to the status of subhuman the Aboriginal community of this country, officially Canada has recognized that gross mistake. It's longer than the 25 years of the promise made to Abraham and Sarah. But it came. Transforming hopelessness and impossibility into hope and grace is the work of God. In our lives, in our nation, in our world. Now, there's a long way to go. It's not just about the apology. There's a long way to go, but this is significant. And so the question that we leave ourselves with today, that each of us is challenged and encouraged and strengthened to answer, is anything too hard for God? Amen.